Welcome back to Tricky Bits with Rob and PJ. You know, when I was a kid, we had ALUs. We were excited when FPUs came out and they became kind of packaged together as just being CPUs. And then someone figured out that, you know what, we're doing this very specific set of linear algebra operations for graphics. So let's create the graphics processing unit, the GPUs. And so we have high-end companies like Matrox and NVIDIA, and at the time, ATI, creating this new set of chip, which was very specifically aimed at a particular type of math. And nowadays, we have extended that, where people went from GPUs to general-purpose GPUs to do interesting computes, which has given rise to a whole flurry of new processing units. Google came out with the Tensor processing unit. We talk about neural engines. Rob, we have this litany of processing units that are out there that seem to be exploding all the time. Why are they different, and what does it all mean?
So they're all kind of derived from the GPU. The GPU and the CPU are the ones with the architecturally biggest difference. We'll get into how they're different. The TPUs and the neural engines are kind of the same thing. They are architecturally very similar, like big grid processors, like a GPU thread warp is, but they're typically a lot lower resolution. They don't do full floating point. They do maybe half resolution, like BF16 format, or they do integer, something that's very low resolution. The TPUs and the neural engines are very much geared towards neural networks, which don't really need the precision. It's more about the sign of those things at some point. I mean, there's a little bit of scale needed. They don't need to be precise. So they make them very big, very small in silicon areas. So big by, there's a lot of them. Maybe there's 1,000, 10,000, whatever the number is, little adders and multipliers, but they're doing very low precision. They operate in a big grid. It's very easy to map a traditional neural network to that architecture. And you can basically have one feeding the other. You can have a if it's a very big neural network, you just do it piece by piece, DMA in, DMA out, it becomes a memory-to-memory operation. So that's all they are. And you can do the exact same thing on a GPU. But it just takes a lot more power because the GPU is power-hungry and it's typically doing higher precision numbers and architecturally might need a bit more hand-holding to get it to work. But all of the AI algorithms we originally had started on GPUs. They started in as compute shaders or CUDA shaders or things like that. And
well, they started before that where they were on CPUs, which were pretty inefficient. We couldn't have very massive block sizes on the CPUs. I mean, we're fairly bound by that.
But you can. You just can't do it real time.
There's
nothing inherent about a GPU that allows it to happen except there's thousands of cores. So why are there more cores on a GPU? Why can't an Intel chip have that many cores? Why does a GPU have 1,000 threads or 10,000 threads or 50,000 threads? An Intel chip only has like two threads on a core, like a hyperthread, or it might have eight cores. And so it has 16 threads total. And it really comes down to expected execution speeds and predictability of the code. So we've talked about this before, that CPUs have branch predictors and they have memory prefetchers to predict the next memory access. And that's because the code typically for a CPU is sequential and unpredictable. It expects individual instructions to execute in a clock cycle, maybe less than a clock cycle. So a floating point multiply, if you need to do it in one cycle, is a massive block of silicon. You might have two of them. So you can do two floating point multipliers in a single clock cycle. And that's a big amount of silicon. It's a lot of power. A GPU doesn't do it in one clock cycle, not even close. It might do it in 16, 32, whatever. It's been coming down, but it's still a big number of clock cycles. But if you can do a floating point multiply in eight clock cycles or 16 and make it pipeline so you can start a new one every clock cycle, you're still getting one floating point multiply per clock cycle. You just have to wait eight cycles for the first one to come out. Because GPUs typically have a lot of data to work on, they can keep this pipeline fed and still get the same throughput as a CPU, but they can't do the same instantaneous computation that a CPU can do. So if you only have one operation to do, a CPU is much faster than a GPU. If you have 64, then that'll fit into what we call a warp, like it's a thread group, all 64 multipliers in the GPU do the same operation at the same time. The thread group has one program counter. So all the execution calls do the same instruction at the same time. And there's a long latency for that result to be visible. From the point of view of one thread, it looks like it's synchronous because in the meantime, it'll take, maybe it takes 8 cycles for it to actually do the operation. But in the meantime, it'll do 8 more threads. So it's like massively hyper-threaded in CPU terms. So from the point of view of one thread, it's synchronous. You just write your code and it works. It knows it can architecturally stack up all of these threads in these little 64 grids because there's so much work to do.
A lot of computations for that frame, like a lot of pixels you got in there, and it's always increasing.
Yeah, I mean, and if you add, and this is kind of NVIDIA did this early on, is architecturally, like all the 30, 40, 10, 20 series GPUs are the same. And this has been true for a long time for NVIDIA. A bigger GPU just has more cores. That means you can do more things at once. And it can do different things at the same time because you can split them in half and you have half the shader cores, you have half the shader cores. So a smaller GPU might have 1,000 shader cores and that's 64,000 pixels in flight at once. And a big one might have 4 times that amount. So now you've got 256,000 pixels in flight at once. But it's the exact same feature set. That's the key there. It used to be early on GPUs, the feature set would be different across different products in the same line, which made programming them very difficult. Mm-hmm. So today, everything from the like the next generation Tegras to a 3090 have the exact same feature set. They can all do all the same operations. It's just how fast can they do those operations and how do they distribute the work? So that's how a GPU manages to execute things in parallel and technically faster than a CPU. Instruction by instruction, they're actually slower than a CPU. And if they were running generic code, a GPU would suffer. The reason they suffer is because regular code has lots of branches. You can, if this is true, do this, else do this.
It's incoherent. It can go anywhere.
Yeah, it can go everywhere. And that's why there's a lot of effort in CPUs put into branch predictors and things like that, and out of order speculation on the execution side. GPUs have none of this. They execute in order, in sequence. But what happens when you get to a branch on a GPU and you've got 64 pixels, all with the same program counter, all executing the same instruction at the same time in the same lockstep method? What happens if pixel A says true, if A is greater than B and it says true, and pixel B says false?
So I know the answer to this because you told me this 18 years ago. It has to take both branches everywhere and mask out the result.
It either has to predicate, yes, it can predicate and do that, where basically it's like the original ARM, like every instruction becomes conditional and it's like, okay, I'll just not do these instructions, but it's still paying the cost to execute them because the other side is executing them. So half the pixels are executing this instruction and half aren't. So the half that aren't really just executing, discard the result, don't care. But then it has to do the other half of the else, like it did the if for these half pixels, but the other half pixels need the else on the if statement. So they now execute their instructions actually, and the other calls that took the if are now doing their discard the results.
And the reason for this is the pipelines have to remain the same length.
They have to stay in sync, and they have to stay the same length, yes. So there's other things you can do too. I mean, that's kind of how predicate works. It's like there's a mask or thread in the thread group as a mask of like, will I or won't I execute this instruction? And if you do a compare, that mask gets set, and all the other instructions either execute or don't execute based on that mask. You can also do an actual jump, but ultimately you have to account for the fact that different pixel needs different amount of work and they all have to stay in lockstep. So branching and loops and things like that can get very complicated on a GPU. And in big operations such as rendering, you kind of want to avoid them. If you've got half, imagine you've got a shadow across the screen. If half the pixels are in shadow and half the pixels are not in shadow, a branch is absolutely fine to use there. But if it's kind of a random thing where every pixel could take a different path, branches tend to get quite expensive on a GPU. They're probably still faster than a CPU just because they can do so much at once. And even if they do twice the work, they do both sides of all the ifs and everything. They're still doing it massively parallel. So overall, it's still quicker.
But CPUs may not have one branch. Often they're handling branches of branches of branches.
Oh, yeah. The speculative execution on a CPU goes many, many branches deep in the branch predictor path. Sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong. But all that takes silicon. It takes a lot of hardware. It takes a lot of power. GPUs would rather use that silicon for more cores. So rather than having a branch predictor, add twice as many cores and maybe knock a few cycles off the execution time. You end up with better maximum throughput, where CPUs have a better dynamic throughput, where you don't know what you're going to execute next, where GPUs tend to have much more flexibility in their scheduling.
One of the things I find fascinating is that the reason we're able to do this is that graphics in particular identified a very specific set of operations, linear algebra, matrix vector operations. We could craft hardware specifically for this. And since we knew, like you say, it was embarrassingly parallelizable because every pixel can be done independently, and we could limit the number of operations to something vastly smaller. We didn't have to worry about branch predictors. We basically were just looking at multiplies and adds. We could then craft the hardware to do a superior job of executing the creation of a frame.
Oh, yeah, but you just jumped in the middle of the GPU architecture. It's if you go way further back than there. Well, let's go all the way back. Silicon Graphics started this in the 70s with they had the reality stuff. And it was basically OpenGL in hardware. It had fixed block of hardware that could do the GL pipeline. It could do local transform, world transforms, projection matrices, spit out triangles at the back end, and it would all be done in hardware. And for a long time, Silicon Graphics ruled the roost. They were fast. They could do all of this stuff in hardware. They had phenomenal throughput for the time, at least. And that was the holy grail. Everybody used Silicon Graphics workstations. And then PCs started to do 3D and software. It was just whatever was fastest for the problem at hand, usually very hand-optimized. And then you got the people like NVIDIA showed up. I guess 3DFX showed up first.
That's true.
And started to do Silicon Graphics type operations. But a lot of early GPUs didn't actually do the entire pipeline. Early GPUs had like a scanline renderer. They could interpolate UVs across a scanline. The CPU, or technically the driver, would still rasterize the edges of the triangle.
Mm.
And it would work out the gradients for the edges, and it would get the hardware to do scanlines. So the CPU was still doing the entire geometry pipeline. It was still doing all the transformations of the geometry. It was just using hardware to spit out little sections of scanline in the shape of a triangle. Over time, the hardware got better. It started to rasterize the whole triangle by itself. And the driver did less work, but still did all of the geometry. And then over time, some of the geometry started to move into hardware. And you got the original GeForce, the TNL, where it was basically Silicon Graphics. It was a fixed function vertex pipeline that did all of the math in hardware and also fed a triangle engine that could render the whole triangle by itself. So you ended up with an end-to-end pipeline, fixed function, that could render in hardware. Basically, it was Silicon Graphics in your PC at that point. And then where did we go from there? Well, it started to be things like, well, I need a second UV coordinate on my input vertices. I need to be able to read two textures. So these fixed function pipelines started to get slightly more programmable, still in the fixed pipe sense. It was, you could have a few flags. Okay, you can pass an extra attribute view through. On the pixel side, it was almost like a blender model. You would take, okay, I want to take this texture and I want to blend it with this model. So the programmability was more of a stack of blenders. This was the original Xbox for the most part. The way DirectX early on exposed it, like look at DX7, it has basically these stackable blenders that you can just stack up. DirectX 8 added a simple shader, which was basically an assembler. It was a vertex assembler and pixel assembler, which kind of did the same things. Vertices started to get actual instructions where you can, okay, I can do a transform by myself. So things started to get more and more programmable.
I remember that. It was exciting times.
And at this point, hardware was still, this is a vertex piece of hardware. This is a pixel piece of hardware. Even the PS3 had that. And then over time, this hardware got more and more programmable, and it started to go, okay, well, now you can do the actual math yourself. And it was still in an assembler form. And at some point, HLSL was added, so it was a high-level shader language, and it looked like C. We still have it today. Around this same time, hardware was unified, so it was a shader core. So this shader core could do a pixel, or it could do a bunch of pixels or a bunch of vertices. And there was a hardware scheduler that would distribute this with help of the driver. So some shader cores in the GPU would be doing a bunch of vertices, and others would be doing pixels, and the driver's job was to keep everything fed all the time. And that just kept progressing and progressing and progressing. And it was all originally used for graphics. And then people started to realize that we could do other operations on this piece of hardware. It's massively parallel. It's rendering all these pixels. How about if we want to do a physics sim? I want to do a water sim, and I want to apply this big physics equation to a bunch of pixels, which are really just, at this point, vectors. So what we started to do is we started to pack data into textures, and we'd use the programmability of the GPU to read these textures, which weren't really textures at all. They were just data structures. We'd do all of the math in the shader as real math, and then we'd somehow pack the result back into a color so we could put it in a frame buffer, because that's all the GPU could do. And this became known as GPGPU, like general purpose GPU programming. And
this was the zeitgeist at SIGGRAPH, I think, back in 07, 08?
Something like that, yeah. It was like, what can you get the GPU to do by very carefully abusing it effectively?
Yes.
Of like, we can pack data, and then GPU sort of add more data formats, floats, ints, things like that.
Right, because you only had 8-bit color RGBA, that, if I recall correctly, like, that was what you output from your fragment shaders back in the day, or pixel.
Not always.
Shaders.
Some of them, when they added floating point support,
yeah,
it was
eventually
a big
they
step
added
in the
more.
Right direction.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, early on, it was like, you got to cram this into RGBA 32-bit textures, and how creative can you get in doing that?
Right. And you didn't have bit shift operations back in the day.
No, but you could multiply, which is
you
same
could
thing.
Multiply, yeah.
And it came at a cost, for sure. But
yep.
You could actually do it. There was an art in writing GPU programs, and anything that needed a big grid of the same operation could be done on the GPU. And I remember talking to Dave Kirk at NVIDIA back in probably the PlayStation, maybe the Xbox days, of like, one day you'll be writing a compiler. And he's like, no way. And then CUDA came out and kind of was the early interface to GPGPU. It was the exact same model, but you no longer had to cram things into textures. Things could just be buffers of data.
Right.
Internally, the GPU was doing the same thing. By this point, it had access to various formats, could do integer shifts, things like that, and floating point operations. And CUDA became this standard interface for doing compute on GPUs.
Well, to be fair, it became the standard interface to doing compute on NVIDIA GPUs.
But they're the ones doing it at this point.
Yeah.
In time. So it was a fair point. And then OpenCL came out, and DirectX 10, maybe, I can't remember, 11, added compute support to the API. And now there was many ways of doing compute. And it's kind of stabilized now that there's DirectX for doing compute intermixed with graphics. And that also works on AMD and Intel. And there's CUDA, which is where everything tends to happen in compute, and NVIDIA are the kings of compute. So an ecosystem started to build. People started to write libraries and things like that for CUDA. And then lots of open source stuff was happening. So now you can basically piece together a massive CUDA application. And it's all open source, or you write a bit of code yourself. NVIDIA contributed a lot of this. And then we got to AI. And AI was, and it's very similar to graphics in that there's lots of individual nodes doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
All very similar things that you could at least write the same way. And so AI, at least initially inference and then later on training, also went to the GPU. And this was all in CUDA at this point. We've long gone past GPGPU. No one uses that anymore.
Right.
Especially because DirectX can interact, compute, and graphics seamlessly. So and everything's compute these days. So AI started to be done on the GPU, and pixels fell to the wayside. It was literally just input buffer, output buffer, and accessing from the CPU and interacting with the CPU became important. It's always been important, but it became important. And lots of other jobs. Supercomputers started to get built out of GPUs because CUDA could distribute wide and far. And so things like predicting the weather and any kind of computational dynamic problem where every little cell is doing the same operation started to move to GPUs.
To the horror of game people everywhere who suddenly had their graphics cards being impacted beyond inflation because there was such demand for them.
Bitcoin mining became the big one, the first bubble of like, we could do all this operation, like each thread of a GPU could be solved, trying to solve a different hash, and you could do billions of hashes a second in total. Even password crackers moved to the GPU because it's lots of operations that are the same over and over and over again. And graphics at the same time was still going on, but at this point you could pretty much do anything you wanted in a shader core. And to support CUDA, we kind of skipped over a bit of this, is initially none of these shaders had dynamic branching.
Right.
It was just a sequence of instructions that you ran. It was always the same. And if you wanted to have some sort of if, you'd have to kind of get a constant of a 1 or a 0 in there, and you'd do both operations, and you either multiply by a 1 or a 0 and add them together. And that's how you did ifs in the early days. And kind of compiler still does that sometimes if it makes sense. But as we progress, this is over a decade of time, instructions were added for static branching, dynamic branching, and you could do loops, and you could start to index different types of memory, and ultimately, everything, all definitions of like some sort of constant went away, and it was just a buffer. So now it's just a CPU reading buffers and writing buffers. It's now a general purpose processor, which is how CUDA managed to be able to be so successful at general purpose computations, because it's exactly a mirror image of the hardware. So then we get to the AI side, and everything was done on GPUs. You could do like inference, all these open libraries, TensorFlow, things like that, became available, and they could run AI models for training or for back-end inference side on the CPU. They could run them on the GPU. The GPU would be much faster for most cases, but very power hungry. So people started to look at like, what are these neural networks doing? And basically each node in a neural network is a multiplying and add. It's a scale of the input neurons, and it's an add at the end. So it's basically a dot product at each node in the neural network. And there's some forcing like normalization function, but that's literally what it's doing. Like it's a big variable size dot product at each neural net based on how many inputs there are. And GPUs were very good at doing this, but people soon realized that accuracy didn't matter. It didn't need to be done at floating point resolution. It could be done at much, much lower resolution. And GPUs always supported like this thing called FP16, which was a 16-bit version of a floating point, a 32-bit floating point number. And for most graphics operations, which are in a fairly small dynamic range, it worked perfectly. Its positions and world coordinates doesn't work so good for, but it does work for pixel values. So people started using this for neural things and worked just fine, but twice as fast. So then hardware started going, well, we could add custom hardware to do this. And NVIDIA added it a few generations ago in their Tensor engine. And it's basically very similar to a shader core, except it's now just super low resolution, very, very fast, massively parallel blocks of multiply and adds. And with that, you can implement pretty much any neural network. So it became possible to start combining them. You got things like a DLSS, where it would AI upsample graphics frames or improve the resolution, because it could use the shader cores for the graphics and it could use the tensor cores for the AI side. And then you get into the bigger GPUs where all they do is just add more of these things. The balance between how many shader cores, which are way more general purpose, versus how many neural engines you have on their tensor cores, which are just do massive matrix operations, like multiply. They literally do multiply and add, and you group them however you wish. That's basically what they scale across these GPUs. And if you get to the really high-end ones, it's thousands and thousands of these tensor cores and not so many shader cores, but still a lot, but they don't necessarily scale linearly. So then you get to things like the Apple Neural Engine. And all that is it's literally the same thing. It's a piece of hardware that can do multiply and adds in a grid And that's all it does. It's not connected to a shader or a GPU. It's just a standalone piece of hardware.
I think that's a good sort of point to make. And I know we kind of missed it early on, but about, I want to say 12 years ago, Apple and NVIDIA had a falling out where Apple effectively said, we're not going to be using NVIDIA chips in our machines anymore. It might have been around the same time that CUDA was becoming popular, but there was this split that happened. So Apple, you know, went on its own path. It dumped OpenGL. It took on Metal. It's created the Neural Engine. And in many ways, that makes sense for what Apple wanted to do. They only own silicon. It is curious, though, that they're not the only people operating this way. Google created TPUs. Facebook's got their own.
Yeah, I mean,
and so everyone's kind of exactly making the same. These massive multiply and add machines.
Yeah, and it's all the only difference between them really is the connectivity on the outside of like, how can you group these blocks of multiply and adds? How do you feed them? How do you connect them together? Is it done through memory? Is it done through DMA? Is it done through just chaining them together in various blocks? Architecturally, they're all kind of the same, but the way the data flows through them is kind of different. And how do you get the data into them? Some of them have like, the TPUs have a PCIe interface, so you just plug them into a PC and you have this big bank of tens of operations that you can use. And it really matters if you're looking at throughput versus power consumption. A GPU probably still has higher throughput, but at a much higher cost per watt. But if you're running a data center, that's a big deal. Like Facebook make their own so they can do all their back-end AI tasks without paying a massive electric bill. And at some point, it's, I guess, cheaper to make your own than it is to keep paying NVIDIA. But they're not really the same ballpark. Like NVIDIA's Tensor engine, that's inside the GPU, and it's a small part of the GPU until you get to the big AI chips that they make today. That's what Apple and that's what Google are competing with. No one's going to expect a Tensor engine to start rendering triangles. No one's going to expect it to start doing graphics. They're totally made for doing low-precision inference of an AI model. And you could abuse them to do all the work, but that's generally what they're used for.
So it's interesting. If they're all effectively doing the same thing, you know, at the lowest level, multiply and adds, and that the interface is what's different, are you really saying that the reason for each of these sort of different flavors of chips is that each of these companies have their own software stacks that they're trying to tune differently, or they're trying to tune to their own software interfaces, even though at the end of the day, it's all just a multiply and add? Like, is that actually what's driving this?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, Apple have their own interface. You can use one of their blah, blah, blah kits to use the neural.
ML kit or whatever.
Engine. I think it is ML, at least that's the main one. There's a handful of them that use it. CUDA has the same sort of interface to drive the Tensor engine. So literally all they're doing is their APIs and drivers are just configuring this outer hardware to like, how do we feed these engines and in what group size can we block it off? Things like that. That's all architectural things that they decide. Can one, if you have a big multiply and add engine, does it have to go from memory back to memory? So then every pass is going back and forth to memory, or can it go from block of multiply and adds to another block of multiply and adds without ever going to memory? Because now you can do a two-stage neural network without having to go back and forth to memory, sucking up bandwidth, et cetera, et cetera. So architecturally, they're all kind of the same, but all kind of different into how you feed them.
Is it fair to say that NVIDIA is still the only one for which you can have, commodity access to, meaning that I suppose I can access the neural engine
TPU. You can access
well, that's in the cloud. Like there's like,
no, you can buy TPUs. You can literally buy PCIe hardware with TPUs on them.
Okay.
And we had one on a Jetson car that an old contract I was doing, and it was basically a Jetson with PCIe slot. And we had TPUs in there to help with the AI processing the GPU could have done, but it was also power hungry and it was busy doing other stuff. So having the extra work helped. But yeah, you can buy them. You can put them in your PC. The Meta ones, the Facebook ones, you can't buy. They're just for them. So architecturally, they're not going to say much. Apple don't say much architecturally about theirs either. The goal, of course, is a lot of these models are huge amounts of data. So you don't want to actually have to process the data. You want to make sure that your DMA engines on the front of these chips and can access the data in the format you want it, or the format it's already made to save you. I mean, the process, if you have to go through this multiple gigabytes of data with the CPU to format it, to send it to a neural engine, you've just lost, you're already at the back of the queue. It's like your neural engine has to be able to fetch the data in the format that it's in. And when you start getting to open systems, TensorFlow, things like that, the hardware vendors start to lose control of the formats, or there becomes a coalition of these are formats that we're going to support. So there is some architectural differences between them, and I wish they would all document them so we could see what it's doing. But the new Qualcomm thing they added, and the one that Intel's adding, they're all exactly the same. They're all for doing low resolution multiplier NADs in some pattern so you can do neural engines with them.
If these are all the same at the end of the day on the hardware level, the lowest level hardware level, is the each of these people coming out with their own version, just marketing? I mean, it feels kind of like a pain in the ass right now if it's like, I don't quite know what the format is of how I should be formatting my data to most efficiently use this chip, and it's different across every single flavor I could get.
Well, as a programmer, you don't format the data. The APIs, like things like TensorFlow and things like that do. The driver has formats that it supports, which obviously map to what the hardware supports. And there has to be some commonality between them all at some level. So is it marketing, was your question? And I would say, to some extent, yes.
Okay.
Because why would Intel add a neural engine to a Pentium that's going to be in a PC with probably an NVIDIA GPU?
Right.
Apple needed one because they have their own stack and they can use the neural engine for power rather than using the GPU.
Right.
But when Intel add one to the CPU, it's like, where do they add it? Do they add it to the GPU side, so it's over the PCIe bus? Do they add it as a new PCIe device inside the CPU, just like the GPUs, into where the GPUs are? Or is it actually part of the CPU core? And a lot of that depends on how it's accessed, and the cost of access will vary. But generally, who would use it? If it's in maybe laptops, maybe things with integrated GPUs, but they're only adding these to high-end PCs. Those high-end PCs probably have a 4090 in them. And the 4090 is probably going to be a lot faster than the Intel neural engine. So why bother, other than the fact that we need to have one? It makes sense for Qualcomm to have
one.
Sure. NVIDIA won't add one because they already have one. Even in the Tegras, they have the Tensor cores that are on the existing CUDA stack,
yep,
part of the shader stack. So they won't add a CPU side Tensor engine. There's absolutely no need to. I've not seen the architecture of the new Intel ones, but I suspect they're on the backside of a PCIe bus. So they, even though they're integrating the same silicon, it's still a PCIe device. And it's going to have all the same access DMA problems that a GPU version has. So there's little benefit other than marketing. I mean, Qualcomm makes sense. They need to compete with Apple and do some of these low-power, yeah, on-chip inference tasks and things like that. But in a PC, it starts to get a little gray as to who are you competing with. If, yes, you can start doing these tasks without using the GPU, but I have the GPU.
To give a little more context of why I asked the question, I remember what you have said in the past about reverse engineering the interface to the PS3 and the RSX chip to get effectively better throughput, you know, better control, like direct access to the command buffers. You could format it. You didn't have to go through Sony's APIs. You could do a better job by going into this stuff directly.
Define a better job there, because there's the work the GPU does,
yep,
which is the same no matter if you use my API or your API.
Right.
The GPU is doing the same, yep, work, doing the same throughput. There's also the other side that people don't think about, is what was the cost of driving that piece of hardware? The PS3, we optimized and went for command buffer access because we didn't want to spend CPU cycles,
right,
to build the command buffer.
Right.
Our API was very thin. This is the same argument for Vulkan DX12 versus the older GL-type APIs, where GL is very heavy. It takes thousands and thousands of CPU cycles to do every operation, where Vulkan's much lower overhead. By low overhead, they mean on the CPU. It's,
right,
not making anything different on the GPU. The command buffer the GPU executes is the same. This is the same here, too. It's like, how much work the CPU has to do to drive the hardware is a critical factor in how fast these devices are, which is what I was saying about formatting the data.
Right.
If you have to have the CPU go and pre-format the data because your hardware is so esoteric, it only takes a weird-ass format, then you've already lost because your amount of overhead on the CPU is huge, given the blip of work the Tensor engine's going to do. They have to be balanced. They have to work in harmony. Otherwise, it's just going to be a bottleneck system.
Which is what, as you said earlier, like what you'd ideally like to do is just hand the API a buffer that's already formatted, and it could just DMA it over, rather than having to do any kind of shenanigans to get it into that format.
And that's how most of them work these days. I mean, early on, it wasn't true. But today, most of them just, okay, here's, you define some structure of your dot products that you need to do for your whatever neural net, however it's configured with its outer inner layer sizes, et cetera, how they're connected, et cetera. There's some sort of description of that in hardware, and it goes and DMAs it by itself. And internally, does it put the result back in memory? Does it feed that result onto the next layer of the neural engine? Really depends on the generation of the hardware and the individual architectures. Some can do it, some can't do it.
So broad strokes on this, is it fair to say that, hey, the reason we went from a CPU to GPU is that we could get vast parallelism out of it for the same work, even though we didn't require the same instantaneous latency, but we were happy at the, in aggregate, latency that we get out of it, versus the TPU, which is like the CPU, except we're saying we want to use less power, and we can accept...
TPU is very much like a GPU. It's nothing like a CPU.
Right. But the difference, though, why I use a TPU nowadays versus a GPU is that it's less precision and less power. Mainly the less power is what I care about, but I can accept the less precision.
And they're simple. So if you were to make a massive chip with just TPUs on it, it would have a billion calls. I mean, they're that simple. They're that tiny.
Got it.
So the TPUs take a tiny amount of silicon for what they give you. And no one really does. Everyone has a neural engine. It's like a little blip. Like, look at the M3. It's a tiny little corner of the chip. What if the entire M3 silicon was just the neural engine? It would basically be, like I said, a billion calls it could do there. And this is what some of the big NVIDIA chips
are. Right.
And it's just that balance of like, yes, it's we've kind of got to a spot where we can do AI and in AI inference in particular on these very low resolution calls. And there's a lot more research happening on making it more viable for more operations. But then how big do you make the hardware? And you've got to balance it of like, at some point, it's just the hardware is just too powerful for what we need to do. It's too big for the models, which fits back into the architecture decision of, if you have a billion calls, say, and you have to use them all at once, no network's that big. You're just going to waste off those calls.
Right.
If you can take that billion calls and break it into a million thousand independent calls, you can now link them together and start doing things. Now you can start doing very complicated neural networks in hardware without ever leaving the chip. So a lot of it's the configurability of these devices, not just how much math can they do. That's the market number. We have this many teraflops. But what's the configurability of that? If those teraflops get wasted because you can't configure the hardware to fit any reasonable neural network, then it's inefficient. Where if you have the configurability to basically get perfect throughput where every single node in that big grid is used, maybe not in the same layer at the same time, but is maybe fed by other layers and you can reconfigure them on the fly. You can do all of the various normalization functions in hardware. Then it works good. Because imagine if you have this massive neural engine and it can't do the normalization function and you've got a node that feeds into a reload function to...
Yep.
Normalize the result. If it can't do that, then you've got to send all that data back to the CPU. The CPU has to go through and do it. And then you send it back to the neural engine, which didn't really buy you anything. And this happens because they'll come up with new normalization, like forcing functions. And now the hardware can't do it, but this new model needs that function. So then you've got to start feeding it back. So that's some of this point, it goes back to the GPU because the GPU can typically do them all. I mean, don't forget, the neural engine's not programmable. It's configurable.
Right.
Isn't necessarily directly programmable.
Maybe yet.
I think at some point you just end up with a low precision GPU if you make it programmable. And I'm not sure it's that useful. I think fixed function configurability right now to fix neural engines that we have, because you always have the GPU to fall back on.
Right. It's pretty fascinating, this bifurcation, you know, in our lifetime where we have CPUs, GPUs, TPUs. I kind of, it makes me wonder if like we're going to continue on this path where we'll have another specialized math operation that we want to create another piece of silicon for. But
well, we can, because we're good at making silicon now.
Here we are.
I mean, that's why we have all of these custom processors. I mean, whether they can all go back, they probably will never converge at this point. GPUs and CPUs are definitely going down different paths. The TPUs is just a, like I said, it's just a low precision GPU, but again, not really programmable in the programmable sense. Configurable is a better word.
Beyond getting sort of smaller and maybe more configurable, do you think there's any sort of future arms that we should be looking out for of how these things would develop?
No, I think interoperability is a big one. I said, like, where are they? Like I said, if they're on the backside of the PCIe bus, then you've got PCI DMA to deal with. You've got local storage. Are they, do they access the main memory? Do they not have access to main memory? Are they easily controllable from the CPU, which ultimately is the gatekeeper of all of it? So I think there's a lot of small architectural changes will fix problems that are associated with those decisions. But generally, for now, I think we're just going down the path we're on. And I think they'll get more flexible. GPUs always getting more flexible. They're adding things like hardware functions for ray tracing, which is obviously graphics related. So people are less shy today of adding fixed function blocks to do specific things. TPUs will just get more configurable. They might change precision. They might get to the point where they can do floating point when they need to and things like that. It's just that natural next step of like, we could do it on the GPU or we could just add this bit of hardware to the TPU and keep it there.
So, and do you think the deciding factor will be power?
To some extent, yeah, because a lot of these things want to work on like phones and mobile devices, and GPUs are expensive and take a lot of power and make things get hot. Where TPUs can do the same number of operations at crap quality, the same result. Doesn't matter what resolution you worked it out to be.
A lot of fun things to come, man.
Yep, but I think you'll start seeing a lot of these devices. In mobile devices, I think everything's going to have some sort of neural engine type device, a grid of low resolution multiplayer ads, so they can do local inference and they can do things like object selection like the iPhone does. And Qualcomm need that same functionality because they power Android phones and they need it, and doing it in pure software is slower, so it's a worse experience. So at least for now, it's going to be tit for tat going across who adds what and who has the bigger numbers. And at some point, no one will care.
I'm curious, do you ever think that we would get to a point where we'd have AI on the TPUs directly rendering graphics rather than having a GPU?
No, of course the resolution.
Okay.
It's not going to be good. I mean, they're already kind of doing that with things like the temporal AI-based upsampling, where it's the AI taking the frame, processing it, outputting another, and going back to the GPU to get the result. So I think letting them work hand-in-hand is better than... If you add all the GPU bits to a TPU, you just made another GPU.
That's true.
So keeping them architecturally good at what they do and keeping them separate but allowing them to interop is probably the best way.